Okay, we haven't talked about slide 9 yet. As you see on the top, we're looking at a close-up of the spaces within bone. What kind of bone are these spaces occurring in? Spongy bone, otherwise known as what? Cancellous bone, yes. And so here is where marrow is. Remember, there are two kinds of marrow, right? What are the two types? Red and yellow. Where is red marrow found? Where? In the entire skeleton early on, in kids, and then by adulthood, the red marrow is in the axial skeleton bones and just the proximal parts of the humeri and femurs. The rest of it is yellow marrow. What is yellow marrow? Fat. Right, so we don't want to concern ourselves with yellow marrow in this chapter because it has nothing to do with the immunity that red marrow is involved with. So this is a close-up of, as you see, a proximal part of the femur, just one example of where red marrow is, but it's also in all these axial bones in an adult. And the marrow collectively is tissue, because it's made up of many different kinds of cells, as we see here. Now, what's not shown here is the blood. The blood is delivered, of course, through vessels, which perforate through the, in holes, through the compact bone. So vessels bring blood into these spaces. But then, instead of having normal capillaries, we have sinusoids. Remember we talked about sinusoids? And so this tan background here, this is the space that blood would be filling. This is part of the bloodstream, actually, but the blood isn't shown here. Surrounding that blood space, of course, are endothelial cells, all these red ones. Those are just like the endothelial cells that would make up a capillary, a run-of-the-mill capillary. These sinusoids are really just modified capillaries, right? So we're really close up in this view because these are single cells, obviously. Anyway, the blood's not shown just for simplicity, but superficial to that, meaning away from the lumen of the sinusoid, we have on the other side of the endothelial cells, in other words, the non-blood side of the endothelial cells, we have this collection of cells in various states of development that make up the bulk of the marrow. And, of course, all of these different kinds of cells come from one kind of cell that we already talked about. What is that? What kind of stem cells? They are pluripotent, exactly. But pluripotent is a kind of a general word. That just simply means that they're able to develop into multiple different things. Specifically, what kind of pluripotent cells are we looking at here? Or did all of these come from? Hemopoietic cells, right. Hemopoietic cells, meaning blood cell-producing cells, are what make up those are the stem cells that reside in the marrow. They're part of the marrow. But then as they are stimulated into hemopoiesis, they divide and their progeny, the cells that they produce, then develop in different pathways depending on what the signal is, to become either red blood cells or any of the various kinds of white blood cells, like we've already talked about. Well, that's all happening on the other side of this boundary with the blood formed by the endothelial cells. All right, and so this is all separate from the bone itself. Not shown. There's no bone shown here, but there would be bony beams. What do we call those bony beams? Question 201. Trabeculae. The trabeculae are the hard parts. Well, we're looking at soft stuff here that would form a boundary with these trabeculae wherever they occur. But then we have this blood space on the other side of the soft aggregate of cells that make up the marrow itself. And, for instance, we see this platelets being formed. We've already talked about this as well. This is a megakaryocyte that is being sloughed off a little bit at a time, forming the platelets, which are part of the formed elements. But the other kinds of formed elements as well, the cells proper, are produced by these hemopoietic cells and squeeze through this endothelial layer by going between the endothelial cells themselves. So that's how all blood cells get into the bloodstream. But they're not all ready to do their job necessarily. Red blood cells are ready to go. White blood cells, depending on what they are, might have to mature somewhere else more. Certain kinds of white blood cells mature here in the marrow and they enter the blood. But also remember from what we've talked about before that while the red blood cells stay in the bloodstream, the white blood cells take a ride in the bloodstream and then most of them exit somewhere, which is why the white blood cell count in whole blood is so low, because most of them leave the blood after they take a ride somewhere and inhabit the various kinds of lymphatic tissue that we've been talking about. For instance, when we saw that lymph nodule, and I think that was the last slide when we left off last time, this lymph nodule is not something that is always there. This one happens to be at the intestines. Lymph nodules form and then deform as need be if invaders come. But lymph nodules are basically collections of white blood cell types that are acting for defense. Okay, well that's enough. Let's go on to 10. In 10, we're looking at the thymus, and we've already discussed the thymus in a different chapter. Well, the thymus is a member of the lymphatic system as well. It is not only a member of the lymphatic system, I should say, it is a lymphatic organ, whereas a lymph nodule, like the one at the intestines we just looked at, that's not a lymphatic organ. It is an aggregate of lymphatic tissue, but it's not a organ in its own right. The lymphatic organs are made up of tissue as well, of course, but what makes them organs is that they are surrounded by a capsule of some sort. So there's a connective tissue layer that defines them as their own separate organ. So the thymus is an example of that, and the spleen is an example, and the tonsils are an example. Those are lymphatic organs. Now, where do we find the thymus? In the mediastinum, right. Anterior to the aortic arch, basically, in the mediastinum. And when is it big? Right, when you are little. Early on, it's much more important. Why does this make sense? Right, that's when you are developing immunity. So that the thymus as an organ undergoes a large decrease in size. What do we call that decrease in size? What is it? Not de-evolution. Not devolution. Involution, right. Involution. And so in an old person who is still alive, it's, you know, almost not there anymore. But we've looked at the baby picture. It's huge in the mediastinum early on. Well, what is the claim to fame of the thymus? Yeah, not production of T cells, maturation of T cells. And what are T cells? Types of? They are a type of white blood cell, right? So keep this all straight in your mind. There are erythrocytes and there are leukocytes, right? Leukocytes is a huge category because it simply means white blood cell. There's major kinds of white blood cells, right? Which we've talked about. Eosinophils, basophils, neutrophils, lymphocytes, and monocytes. Those are all leukocytes. Lymphocytes is one type of leukocytes, and there are different types of lymphocytes. T cells are just one type of lymphocytes. So there are a few major kinds of lymphocytes. Natural killer cells, T cells, and B cells. But there are subcategories of T cells and there are subcategories of B cells. Anyway, those T cells are, like all other blood cells, created via hemopoiesis in the marrow. But unlike B cells that mature in the marrow, T cells leave the marrow in a very immature state, enter the blood, and migrate to the thymus, where they then undergo two stages of maturity, really, which corresponds structurally to the fact that the thymus is an example of an organ, like others we've talked about, that has two major layers to it. So there's a cortex in the thymus, and there's a medulla. But unlike other organs that we've talked about, where there is one cortex to the entire organ, and then a medulla deep to that. Remember, cortex always means more superficial. Medulla means deeper. Unlike others, like the brain, for instance, or the kidney, the thymus is divided into, first of all, two major halves, or close to halves, called lobes. But each lobe is made up of several lobules, which, of course, means small lobes. So these kind of circular things that you see here, each one of those is a lobule. There's many lobules. Well, the cortex and the medulla compartmentalization occurs in each lobule, not in the overall organ. So a lobule will have a cortex and a medulla deep to that, and the next lobule will have its own cortex and a medulla deep to that. What we're seeing then in the box here, that's a photomicrograph, that's one lobule defined by those trabeculae. The white streaks are connective tissue walls, kind of like partial partitions in an office where you're not in separate rooms, but the little partitions. That's what these trabeculae are. But these two trabeculae define that one lobule, and we're looking at that one lobule in cartoon form on the bottom here. So the right half of this bottom cartoon is the cortical region. It's the cortical region because it's close to the boundary, the capsule that encloses the lobule. The deeper part, on the other side of the dashed line, and of course it's not a stark boundary, it's kind of a transition zone, but to the left of the dashed line is the deeper part, which is the medulla. And I said a little bit ago that the T cells undergo two stages of maturity once they finally reach the thymus. Well, the first of those occurs in the cortex. And so that's where they are sent first. Now, in the cortex, in addition to the T lymphocytes, or the T cells that we're talking about, there are a bunch of reticular epithelial cells that really define the stuff of the cortex. They're structural cells, in part. But they also surround, you don't really see it here, but they form boundaries around blood capillaries. And they therefore, these reticular cells, reticular epithelial cells, contribute to what is called the blood-thymus barrier. Now, we've talked a little bit about the blood-brain barrier, right? Which separates the blood from the brain. Only certain things are allowed to cross that. Well, the same thing's happening here. And that's really to protect these immature T cells during the first phase of their maturation from the things that are in the blood. And so that first phase of maturation that occurs in the cortex involves what's called positive selection. Now, T cells, which we'll talk more about later, operate by recognizing things. And so positive selection provides a test for this population of T cells. Positive selection is a way to screen the cells to make sure that they're able to recognize a group of proteins called the major histocompatibility complex that we'll look at again at later. If they can't do that, then they're useless as T cells. So positive selection basically gets rid of ones that aren't able to do that. If they pass that test, then they migrate to the medulla, which doesn't involve the blood-brain barrier. And here, these now partially competent cells are given another test. And that test is to make sure that they do not recognize self cells as foreign cells. So first, the positive selection makes sure that they can work as T cells. The negative selection, which is called in the second phase, that happens in the medulla, that ensures that they don't recognize your own cells as unself cells. An important part of immunity is to distinguish between self and non-self. Okay? Well, certain ones of these graduates from positive selection will actually recognize your own cells as invaders, and you don't want that to happen, right? So those ones are eliminated in negative selection. And therefore, after this whole process, which takes weeks, the T cells that are just right are then allowed to enter the blood. All right, let's go to 11. Well, it might look like a slide from the digestive system chapter. We're looking at large intestine here. But this, that's just because the large intestine is one of several places in the body where there is quite a concentration of lymph nodes. And the lymph nodes that occur around the intestine, those usually go by an eponymous name called Peyer's patches. Can everyone see this white ink? That one probably could be thrown away. That's an eponym, of course, named after some person. Do they even use that on this slide? Anyway, these little lymph nodes that you see here are called Peyer's patches when they're occurring at the intestines. Other places, we just call them lymph nodes as usual. But that's one place where you have quite a few lymph nodes. You also have a bunch of them located inguinally. The inguinal region is right where the lower limbs connect with the torso. And that's why you have quite a few lymph nodes in that region, because they're receiving lymph from these entire limbs, which are pretty big portions of your body by mass, right? There's a lot of blood that's sent to your lower limbs, and therefore there's a lot of lymph that leaks out and gets reclaimed. Well, lymph nodes in general, remember, are stations along the way back to the bloodstream where lymph, which has picked up invading microorganisms, can be filtered repeatedly. So as lymph goes from lymphatic capillaries originally to bigger and bigger vessels until it finally gets delivered via the collecting ducts into the bloodstream, it will pass through successive lymph nodes along the way, like rest areas on a highway. And remember that I said they get slowed down at those lymph nodes because they get wide. Well, that slowing down gives the lymph nodes chance to filter out debris and allow the various kinds of white blood cells to deal with that debris, whether it's just chemicals or entire cells that could hurt you. They're dealt with in the lymph nodes more so than anywhere else. This is a close-up of just a single lymph node. And about how many of these are in your body? 400 to 500, yeah, somewhere in there. There's variability from individual to individual, but there are hundreds. And most of them have a more or less bean shape to them. So they're kind of crescent-shaped, as you see, and therefore they have an indent on one side, which is called the hilum, H-I-L-U-M. We'll see other organs that have a hilum as well. But the hilum is where vessels connect to that surface. Notice that there are blood vessels, but there are also, there's also one or a few lymphatic vessels connecting to the hilum. Well, at the hilum, the lymphatic vessels are efferent. And what does that mean in general? Efferent means what? Sending away from, rather than bringing toward. So notice that there are afferent lymphatic vessels labeled here as well, but on the other side of the node, not at the hilum. At the convex side, in other words, are the afferent vessels, lymphatic vessels. The hilum is the concave side, and that's where the efferent vessels are. So afferent lymphatic vessels bring lymph to a node. Efferent lymphatic vessels drain that node of lymph and send it on its way, which could be eventually toward another node or several other nodes until it finally gets to the bloodstream. But in general, you have a greater number of afferent lymphatic vessels bringing lymph to the node than you have efferent vessels draining the node. And this should make sense to you just because there's convergence in the lymphatic vasculature in general, right? You go from a hell of a lot of lymphatic capillaries to a smaller number of the next size up and so on until you finally have just two collecting ducts. So nodes are places where the vasculature merges or converges. It shows just one efferent lymphatic vessel here, but there could be a small number greater than one. The point is you have fewer efferent than afferent. Inside the node itself, similar to the thymus that we just looked at, you have trabeculae or partial walls inside here as well. There's an overall capsule, connective tissue capsule. That's what really defines the shape of the node. But then the inner surface of that capsule is continuous with these partial walls that are in this organ also called trabeculae. And so it's a kind of a chambered, only partially chambered organ, the lymph node. Unlike the thymus, which had lobules, and each lobule had a cortex and a medulla, this is more like a kidney, which it's kind of shaped like as well. What I mean by that is that the overall node has one cortex and one medulla. And the medulla part which is lighter lavender here, is the region right around the hilum, just deep to the hilum. The cortex part is wrapping around that medulla. And so notice that the cortex of the lymph node includes a bunch of lymph nodules. Each one of these roughly triangular, darker purple regions is a lymph nodule. So we looked at a picture of a lymph nodule earlier in the deep to the epithelium of the intestine. Here we have lymph or lymphatic nodules making up the lymph node itself. These ones are more permanent than the lymphatic nodule I said that come and go in various tissues like the intestine. So these trabeculae are these partial walls that separate lymphatic nodules. Well, each lymphatic nodule, just like when you find them elsewhere, is mostly a collection of various kinds of white blood cells operating for defense, either phagocytic or releasing chemicals, somehow protecting you. They can grow in size, though, these lymphatic nodules, if some sort of invading microorganism is present. In other words, in response to pathogenic cells that happen to be in the body and therefore make their way into the lymph that enters these nodes, cells that make up what are called the germinal center of the lymphatic nodule will be stimulated to copy themselves, so that you have a lot more cells on hand to deal with this offending pathogen. This is why, in response to infection, you have enlarged lymph nodes. And this is why, in places like the inguinal regions, or the neck, the cervical region also features a bunch of lymph nodes, because that's draining the entire head. Those two places particularly are available to palpate. You can easily feel them without cutting into someone. And so if there's infection, that's manifested by enlargement of lymph nodes, which a lot of people incorrectly say are swollen glands. It's not your glands that are swollen, unless you have the mumps. Right? Mumps is swollen salivary glands. But when you feel your neck for swollenness, that's the swollenness of lymph nodes, not any glands. But it's in response to the fact that these germinal centers are activated to make a bunch of more white blood cells in these lymph nodes in response to whatever the invader is. Okay, let's go to 13. Talk about tonsils. Now, tonsils also are actual organs rather than just lymphatic tissue, because they have their own connective tissue covering. Not so thick a capsule as we find on the spleen, for instance, but an epithelial lining that actually defines them as their own organ. And there are three major kinds of tonsils. That's not to say there are three tonsils. There are three categories of tonsils. We have one pharyngeal tonsil, which you see right here in this sideways view. Pharyngeal tonsil, of course, is named for the fact that it's on the wall of the pharynx, but specifically it's on the part of the pharynx that's posterior to the nasal cavity. The pharynx, remember, is a common passageway for air, food, and drink. So it's kind of like a hallway in a house with different doors to different bedrooms, right? So things pass through there. Depending on who they are, they go to different rooms. The parents go to one bedroom, the kids to another bedroom. Well, in the pharynx, the air goes through the common part, but then makes its way to the trachea, whereas food and drink enter through, or go through the pharynx, but then leave through a different place to go through to the esophagus. So there's a single pharyngeal tonsil, which is what we call adenoids. It's one tonsil, though. Then there are paired palatine tonsils, so one on either side of the roof of the mouth in the back, which is the palate, right? That's why they're called palatine. And those are the ones that used to be yanked out routinely when someone got an infection. Because in response to that infection, the tonsils grow. They get enlarged because they're fighting off the infection. Well, it used to be, well, we'll deal with this just by ripping them out surgically. So a lot of people had their tonsils removed a long time ago. Those are the ones that usually were surgically removed, the palatine tonsils, not the others. Nowadays, they're left in, if they can be left in, much more often than just actually tonsillectomizing them. But anyway, those are the palatine tonsils, there's a left and a right one. And then there are several different lingual tonsils, which are, as the name indicates, arranged on the surface of the tongue, but the rear surface of the tongue that's hard to see when you stick your tongue out. But any given tonsil is really just similar to a lymph node in that it is a place where you have a large collection of white blood cells of various types aggregated together for the purpose of killing invading microorganisms or cleaning up the debris from killing them. And why does it make sense that the tonsils are here? Well, you need protection from these cell populations at the various places where you have easy entrance of microorganisms into the body. So things enter your mouth and your nose. Those can, you know, the air you breathe contains bacteria, even. Certainly the water and the food you drink, there's billions of bacteria that you take in by food and drink every day. But you also, you can breathe them in. There's bacteria are ubiquitous. They're just about everywhere you find living organisms. So these things could get into your tissues most easily right here where you take in food, drink, and air. It's a major potential point of entry for pathogens. And therefore, you have these gatekeepers, basically, the tonsils, ready to kill as many as possible. Now, that they don't kill all of them, of course. You're continuously swallowing millions of bacteria, including the ones that you first breathe in. When you breathe in, that air, of course, after going through the pharynx, is sent to the trachea, right? But the inner lining of the trachea is coated with mucus, first of all, but also ciliated cells underneath that. So the mucus allows the bacteria to stick to it, keeps them in place, keeps them from going farther down through the bronchi and then the bronchioles and into the lungs. But once they're stuck into place, they're swept backwards, back up toward the throat by the action of the cilia. That brings them to the place in your throat where you can go down the other part of the hallway and enter the esophagus instead of the trachea. So you swallow some directly, some you inhale, but they're swept back up so that you can swallow them. And that makes good sense, right? Because putting them into the stomach is a good way to get rid of them as well, because only certain kinds of bacteria are able to withstand the extreme acidity of the stomach. So you send them to the garbage disposal of your body, basically, the stomach. A lot of them, though, don't get past the tonsils to begin with because of the white blood cells operating there. Okay, now to 14. Another example of a lymphatic organ in its own right is the spleen. So it has a well-defined capsule You can tell that you're looking at, you know, you can tell where the spleen ends and begins. It's well defined. And where do you find the spleen? Well, first of all, it's abdominal. It's not thoracic. But it's as close to the thorax as it could possibly be, because what is the official boundary between thorax and abdomen? The diaphragm. And so in a person, in a normal person, the left side of the very top of the abdomen, tucked right immediately below the diaphragm, which you can see right there in the cadaver view, is the spleen. So it's in the extreme upper left corner of the abdominopelvic cavity, and the diaphragm is resting right on it. It's also packed right in there against the stomach, not which has been removed here, but would be in this area, and the left kidney. So the stomach and the kidney and the diaphragm are all pressing against it, basically, continuously. And that's why when you look at the spleen itself, you can see some concavities or dents in it corresponding to these other organs that are right there. So there's the gastric area where the stomach takes up space. And there's the renal area, which is where the left kidney meets it. The spleen is another example of an organ, just like the lymph node that we looked at a little bit ago, that has a hilum. And this hilum is named for the same reason. It's a place where you have tubes running into and out of the organ at that place. So there are major blood vessels, both arteries and veins, penetrating the capsule at the hilum. All right, splenic artery, splenic vein, bring blood to and take blood from the spleen at the hilum. Once you're inside the spleen, of course, the arteries branch and branch again and branch again until you're down to capillaries. But once again in the spleen, you don't have the normal setup of capillaries. You have sinusoids making up the stuff of the spleen as well. So we're looking at the interior on the bottom photograph. Here and there you see blood vessels. But what makes up the stuff of the interior of the spleen are two kinds of pulp, as they're called, red pulp and white pulp. And you can kind of see their color differences here. White pulp is rendered whitish compared to red pulp because of a much higher concentration of white blood cells compared to red pulp, which is dominated by erythrocytes, or red blood cells. All right. Now, the white pulp, though, it's not just randomly occurring, these two types. The white pulp surrounds the blood vessels that are bringing blood in, and so they form like sleeves around the vessel itself. The white pulp does. The vessel itself, these sinusoid capillaries, those are allowing for a lot of leakage out of the bloodstream. Okay, so that's just a hallmark of sinusoids in general. They're very leaky capillaries, right? So blood is coming in through the splenic artery, branches into smaller and smaller vessels until it becomes these sinusoids that are surrounded by white pulp. Therefore, the cells that get squeezed out of the bloodstream from these sinusoids, the first things they're going to come into contact with are the cells that make up the white pulp, and therefore those are white blood cells. That's why they are arranged like sleeves around the blood vessels, so that anything that is in the blood that shouldn't be there, a cell that is not one of your own cells, an invading cell, those will be dealt with immediately by these various kinds of white blood cells that make up the white pulp. But also, healthy red blood cells exit as well. They get squeezed out. Well, this is a test for red blood cells. I talked about this a little bit before in the blood chapter, I guess it was. Red blood cells don't last very long, right? They can't repair themselves because they are enucleate. And they have a lot of mechanical stresses as they get squeezed through all the small capillaries in the systemic and pulmonary circuits. Well, the spleen is an even more challenging squeeze, basically. So only the comparatively young and still mechanically sound red blood cells are able to be squeezed out of the bloodstream and survive that process of being squeezed. The ones that have seen better days, because they've been around too long, are going to be exploded by that squeezing process. And their remnants then are going to be dealt with as the way we've talked about it before, where hemoglobin gets recycled and whatnot. That happens to the red blood cells that, when they get squeezed through these sinusoids, just don't survive that process. The ones that do survive will be returned to the bloodstream for however many more days until they are too old and don't make that test either. So the spleen is important for the lymphatic system and for the circulatory system. It filters blood of pathogens and debris, and therefore it's made of a bunch of reticular tissue, just like lymph nodes are, that act like little nets for filtering. So that's an immune function of the spleen, but it also functions as a filter of red blood cells to get out the ones that are no longer usable and leads to their death, and the debris will be dealt with accordingly. The healthy ones then eventually collect into veins and leave through the splenic vein. Now, because of this arrangement, the interior of the spleen has a lot of spaces in it. It's not a well-sealed system of tubes like capillaries are elsewhere. And therefore, if the capsule, the outer wall of the spleen, gets damaged, if it gets ruptured by a spleen punch or some other injury, you have a bloody mess on your hands, because when you break that capsule open, the stuff inside is fairly loose and just blood everywhere. And it's usually impossible for it to heal if it gets damaged that way, which is why typically what will happen is they'll just splenectomize the person, because you can live without a spleen. It's better to have one, certainly, because you lose that immune function. It's an immunity compromise if you take the spleen out. All right, now, before I actually get to slide 15, let's talk about a couple of things that will probably last even longer than what we have left anyway. So just call this slide 14 and a half. As far as immune functions are concerned for the lymphatic system, well, or just in the body in general, not even just the lymphatic system, but immunity or protection against things that can harm you occurs in three major lines of defense, as they're called. So you have the first line of defense, second line of defense, third line of defense. And they're different from each other for various reasons. The first line of defense really refers to physical barriers. And so what is the major barrier between you and the environment? the skin, but also in addition to the skin, you have the mucous membranes. Now, the skin is not a mucous membrane, it's a membrane. And remember, when I'm using the word membrane there, I'm talking about a multicellular membrane, not a membrane of a cell. So a membrane made up of many cells, thick. It's not a mucous membrane because it doesn't produce mucus, right? It's a dry, comparatively dry membrane. It's not the only covering of your outer surface, though. Because remember, what we call our outer surface is really only part of our outer surface. You also have invaginations into your body, and actually a tunnel all the way through your body, right? The alimentary canal, digestive tract. That has a surface that is really an outside surface of your body as well. But that's a mucous membrane because that membrane produces mucus. And remember the difference in spelling between mucus and mucus. Mucus, the adjective, is M-U-C-O-U-S. That means producing mucus, which the stuff, the noun, is M-U-C-U-S. So you not only have mucous membrane lining the entire alimentary canal from mouth to anus, but also the other entries in invaginations into your body. Reproductive tract is really outside of your body as well, so that has a mucous membrane. Respiratory tract, urinary system also is outside of your body largely. That's a mucous membrane. So all of these places, all these mucous membranes combined, plus the skin, make up the first line of defense. And that really is trying to prevent the passage of bacteria primarily, but other pathogens as well, from getting past that barrier into the cells that are deep to that, the cells that make up the rest of your body, the bulk of your body. So it's a physical barrier, but can also involve some chemical defenses. Now, speaking of the skin, it's dry, it's not perfectly dry, but it's drier than the mucous membranes. And just that dryness itself is a line of defense, because things can't live without water. So only certain bacteria can survive on the fairly dry conditions on your skin. Now there's enough there to outnumber your own cells, but still, that dryness itself means it's inhospitable to a lot of things that might harm you. In addition to that, though, the skin produces substances that don't make life very easy for microscopic inhabitants. And so we have in the skin, or at the surface of the skin, the superficial surface, what is called the acid mantle of the skin. So sweat and sebum, which are two secretions from skin glands that we've talked about in 201, those contain a mixture of things that make the solution acidic. Lactic acid and fatty acids, as their name indicate, both make the solutions therein acidic. Sweat and sebum, remember, is just skin oil. Those make up this acid mantle, which gets, it's produced just here and there by the glands, but it's when it's secreted onto the surface, the entire skin surface gets coated with this acid mantle. So it's a lower pH compared to the rest of your body, and that also prevents a lot of certain things from growing there. Where are we? Quitting time? Yeah, I guess so. We'll stop there.